From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The war against terrorism is momentarily quiet, but looming on the horizon is a far more volatile conflict between India and Pakistan, mainly over the disputed territory of Kashmir. Troop deployments by both nuclear powers are ominous, and the media rhetoric bellicose. Joining us once again to discuss the foreign coverage of that region is Martin Walker, chief correspondent for United Press International. Martin, India's stated rationale for its hard line on Pakistan is its belief that Pakistan is, at a minimum, giving aid and comfort to terrorists in the disputed territory of Kashmir. In the Pakistani press, is there any acknowledgement of that relationship between terrorist acts and the Pakistani government?
Yes, there is. The Frontier Post, which is published in Peshawar, it's an independent daily newspaper, actually says that the Pakistani government really, you know, has to meet this demand. After the 9/11 episode, it says, the world has been transformed dramatically. Our government has to come to grips with the militant groups working on their own agendas under the guise of the Kashmir cause, not because the Indians want it, nor because the Americans want it, but because Pakistan's own national interests and the Kashmir cause demand it. I find that a strikingly moderate statement from one of the main Pakistani papers, and it contrasts with an editorial in the Times of India, which is the establishment newspaper of India, which actually sent chills down my spine when I read it. And it says, a cross-border military strike is fraught with all manner of consequences, including the possibility of a nuclear exchange. While this alone need not deter India, eek. The global conjuncture suggests a new policy of relentless non-offensive actions could pay dividends. Chief among these ought to be the issue of withdrawing from the Indus Waters treaties, whose sole purpose was to guarantee the waters of the three northern rivers to Pakistan. In other words, if we're not going to nuke them, we'll kill them with thirst.
Cistern rattling.
It is very much indeed more than saber-rattling. This Indian policy is one which the European press has really spoken about with almost one voice in saying only America can now act. And I've been reading this in the Italian, in the German, in the Spanish, in the French press, and in the British press. The liberal Guardian stresses a nuclear doctrine must now become part of America's long-term vision. With billions of lives at stake, the onus is on America to ensure that all sides start talking again.
Do they have any ideas for what the United States can do to diffuse the tensions?
Talk a lot. And also, in a sense, readjust its thinking. In Frankfurter Rundschau, which is a left-of-center German daily, the editorial said, as long as President George W. Bush allows the analysis of the new global situation through the crosshairs of the Pentagon and not through the wider angle lens of critical observers and diplomats, there is not even a diplomatic approach from America to formulate the Kashmir question anew. America has to do better than this, and only it can. Even in the Middle East, we're getting the same call from Qatar's Al-Watan. The irresponsible acts of Pakistanis and Indians unfortunately justify calls by the West for not allowing third world countries to own nuclear technology. But that must be a secondary consideration to the need for America to step in to prevent this war getting out of hand.
This strikes me as such a wonderful example of the world's ambivalence about American hegemony. They hate the world that harbors but one sole superpower, and yet they seem to, at the same time, embrace it. Am I obsessing about this too much?
No, you're not. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It seems that America is damned if it does intervene in the world's affairs, and even more damned if it doesn't when people get frightened. I think the reason why people are now desperate is something that I've picked up both in the British press and in the German press, is, as the Times put it, the immediate danger is perhaps similar in character to that which existed in July 1914 after Serbian terrorists had murdered the Austrian Archduke. No one will succeed in preventing the war in which both India and Pakistan public opinion seem to support. This was what led Europe to the trenches in 1914. There is a real sense that this could be the most dangerous war of all.
Well, that's sobering because in 1914 there were no nukes.
There weren't, but it was the suicide of the old European civilization anyway. It saw the end of the German and the Austrian and the Russian empires.
Martin, once again, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the chief international correspondent for United Press International.
Earlier this week, The Wall Street Journal reported on information found in a couple of al-Qaeda computers purchased, as luck would have it, by one of its reporters in Afghanistan. The computers, apparently used by al-Qaeda to coordinate its operations, contained hundreds of documents and files, including correspondence with militant Muslims around the world and plans for producing chemical and biological weapons. Referring to those weapons, one memo read, "We only became aware of them when the enemy drew our attention to them by repeatedly expressing concern that they can be produced simply." That enemy, says 60 Minutes producer Peter Klein, is Peter Klein and all the other reporters who cover bioterrorism. And he joins us now. Mr. Klein, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So when you read that in the Wall Street Journal, what was your immediate reaction?
Well, I really had chills. Specifically because of the reference of enemy. I never imagined myself as the enemy.
Well, I mean, the fact that al-Qaeda refers to you as an enemy is not really the most nightmarish aspect of all of this, I would imagine.
Right. Now, we've had conversations in the newsroom many, many times covering bioterrorism. How much should we reveal? You know, is saying that anthrax is easy to produce, is that a bad thing to say? Is that going to inspire someone to go produce anthrax? I guess what it made me realize is how much power the press has, and something I don't think about regularly on a daily basis.
Now, you and Mike Wallace not long ago won an Emmy for a report you did on how easy it would be to create a smallpox epidemic.
Right.
Did you think about that when you read this memo from the al-Qaeda computer?
I did. That story aired in October of 2000, and strangely enough, just 2 weeks before the September 11th attack as well, we re-aired it. But in that report, we have a Russian biologist who worked on the Russian bioweapons program explain how simple it was to produce 20 tons of smallpox using nothing but chicken eggs in an incubator. We have an American scientist who explains how simple it would be to fill a building because it's communicable. We had another doctor who explained how difficult it would be for an American doctor to notice smallpox, that it would spread throughout the country before anyone would notice it because we're not on high alert. Our agenda there, our purpose there, of course, was not to tell people go out and spread smallpox because it's easy to do. It was to alert the public and to alert officials that doctors need to be trained to notice smallpox, that we need to realize that this is a threat out there. But we did discuss at the time, you know, how much of this should we be revealing?
But this is information we all already know. One thing you didn't outline in your piece is where you can obtain smallpox. Is it easy to obtain? Actually, that has come out in some recent Nightline report, I think. Do you think there's enough information in the general media about these weapons to enable somebody to actually build one or to simply sound the clarion call of the threat of them?
I think virtually every journalist worth their salt in this country has been, certainly since September 11th, but I think even before September 11th, very, very, very conscious of the fact that we do not want to give a recipe out there, whether it's to build a nuclear dirty bomb or biological weapons bomb. And in fact, in conversations with experts, I was in the office of an epidemiologist a couple of years ago. He opened his drawer and he said, "This small credit card size mechanism, which you can buy in so-and-so type of store, could do this or that." You know, my first inclination was to, you know, ask him to bring that to the interview, to show that to Mike Wallace, to, you know, to talk about that. Certainly now, that wouldn't even be a first thought. But, I mean, I guess I'm proud that when I thought it through, I didn't want to do it, and frankly, he didn't want to do it either. You know, I think that goes on all the time when we're covering biological terrorism. So the answer to your question is no. I don't think that if you read every single newspaper and magazine and television story done about biological weapons, you would not be able to cobble one together with just that information.
But it still gave you chills when you read that al-Qaeda had gotten the idea from the enemy, that is the Western press.
The idea that they were sitting around and had never thought of biological weapons until the Western press started saying how simple it was to do. Yeah, that gave me chills.
Will it lead you to change your behavior in any way?
I think the end product, the piece that gets on the air, will be exactly the same. What's changed is the process that goes on in my mind. I mentioned earlier the example of the scientist showing me and telling me how one could fill a building with a biological weapon with readily available materials. At this point, I would never even consider asking him to put that on, whereas before, I would consider it and then reject it.
Peter Klein, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Klein is a producer for 60 Minutes on CBS. This week, we received a boatload of letters protesting our report by Philip Martin on the conflict between NPR and pro-Israel groups. The Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, or CAMRA, listed a number of objections to our piece on its website, camera.org, and urged its members to write, and many did, and so did many others.
For instance, Joshua Hurwit of Oswego, New York, notes that Mr. Martin failed to mention CAMRA's numerous in-depth studies of NPR as the basis for its charges of pro-Palestinian bias. This, he writes, leaves listeners with the impression that CAMRA criticizes the individual story and doesn't examine the sweep of coverage over a long period of time. This is patently false. Jonathan Reich of Lakeland, Florida, also made that point, adding that, quote, bias is frequently not perceived by the perpetrator. The people who produce NPR's Middle Eastern news are well-known supporters of the Arab position, and thus it is hardly surprising that the bias is there.
And Larry Pollack from Columbus, Ohio, says similarly that he was not at all surprised to hear the NPR distortions about CAMRA. Among my friends, he writes, NPR has come to stand for the National Palestinian Radio Network.
Oy vey, Smear.
Like a vault. John Clem from Carouge, Switzerland, finds it disconcerting that so many financially important NPR supporters have such a visceral attachment to their own perception of a single issue. They undermine their cause, he writes, by giving credence to, quote, the belief that Jewish interests are working behind the scenes to coordinate punishment on those who dare question Israel's moral high ground.
On our piece about using dead celebrities as posthumous pitchmen, Christopher Cole of Charlotte, North Carolina, objects to what he sees as our suggestion that there's something disreputable about commerce. It gives a whole new purpose to men and women who have departed from society, he writes. They're dead, moldering in their graves. I think it honors them to bring their memories to new generations, especially in their primes. What about kids who see Louis Armstrong in a Coke commercial and ask their parents about him? They may be inspired to learn more.
We prefer to hear from living, breathing listeners, so email us with your comments to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, the fog of war on the big screen and the worship of ferrets on the newsstands.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Black Hawk Down opens later this month. It's a war movie starring Josh Hartnett and Ewan McGregor about what is widely perceived as an American military disaster, the 1993 raid in Mogadishu, Somalia, in which two U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopters were shot down, 18 soldiers killed, and more than 70 injured. Hundreds of Somalians also died that day. The movie is based on the book by Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Mark Bowden that meticulously traces through eyewitness accounts and leaked documents the events leading up to that terrible day. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
Now, your book was about a mission in Somalia where 18 American soldiers died. Did the military turn even more skittish about giving out information after that?
Well, they were already pretty skittish. One of the reasons I think that so few Americans really knew anything about the Battle of Mogadishu is that there were no reporters in country when this happened.
Just one, I think, Paul Watson.
Well, there was a fellow from the Toronto Star, Paul Watson. He was there mostly, as I understand it, as a photographer. But there were no American reporters present.
Now, we went back and looked at the coverage at the time. It was immediate. There wasn't any effort to cover up that something had gone seriously wrong. And within a day, Paul Watson's pictures of an American serviceman being dragged through the streets were all over the world. Did people within the military say, we can't be embarrassed like that again?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much, Brooke, people in the military. It was the political establishment. In fact, in this case, the Pentagon had requested what's known as an AC-130 gunship, which is really kind of hard to hide. If the president had authorized it, it would have attracted, I think, a lot of press back into the country. So in this case, it was a political decision to refuse the Pentagon's request for the AC-130, primarily because I believe the White House was worried that it would attract a lot of media attention. But there's no question that in modern times, the military has decided to keep journalists away from special ops units like the Rangers and Delta Force. And since most of our deployments around the world involves these special ops units, it's had the effect of basically journalists being kept far away from any military action.
I understand that most every cadet at West Point and midshipman at Annapolis has read your book, but you didn't get much official cooperation. What did you have to do when you were writing the book to get access to the tapes, the records, and the flight logs that you used to reconstruct the battle?
Well, they were leaked. The information came not from any official source, but from individuals who had been involved in the fight.
The Pentagon gave you no problems when you used that same material to reconstruct the battle on film?
On film, no. Interestingly, the Pentagon at that point had no objection. Theoretically, all of the information about this battle, or much of it, is classified. Delta Force itself, which is depicted in the movie, is a unit so classified the Army doesn't even acknowledge it exists. And yet they were willing to come out and assist in the making a movie that depicts the characters and the action of these soldiers very accurately. So there are no hard and fast rules here.
Sometimes with movies like Top Gun or Pearl Harbor, the military cooperates because they think it's good public relations. What about the movie version of Black Hawk Down?
They've probably made a good judgment in this case in terms of, you know, their own interests, because I suspect that while it tells the story of a military mission that basically had the plug pulled on it and was not perfect by any means, it captures the nobility of soldiers in combat and their service. So I think that's why they cooperated. And I think while people watching the movie will receive it in many different ways, my hunch is that young men will be inspired by it.
Mark Bowden, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mark Bowden is the author of Black Hawk Down. The movie, based on the book, arrives in theaters across the country this month.
The debate over whether America should resort to torture in order to extract information from suspected terrorists has aired on the editorial pages of America's papers and on cable and radio talk shows. But you won't find the issue dealt with in the local Cineplex unless you live next to an art house showing the 1966 film The Battle of Algiers. That movie depicts the steps French paratroopers took in the late 50s to dismantle the National Liberation Front, or FLN. Bruce Hoffman, a terrorism analyst for the RAND Corporation, has used the Battle of Algiers in courses he's taught to graduate students. Bruce, welcome to OTM.
Pleasure to be here, Bob.
In the January issue of Atlantic Monthly, you recommend this movie to soldiers, spies, and students. Why?
Well, I think the key to understanding the film is that, like all good films, it's about a search. And in this case, it's the search for intelligence, for information that the authorities need to uproot the terrorist infrastructure in Algiers during the 1950s. The Italian director, Gillo Pontecorvo, displayed a cast of characters which both did egregious things. You have, on the one hand, scenes of the terrorists planting bombs in cafeterias frequented by high school and university students. On the other hand, you have the French paratroops using perhaps the most heinous methods of torture to extract information. And what it underscores is that countering terrorism is first and foremost an intelligence game, and that the primacy of intelligence is paramount.
Pontecorvo was sympathetic with the FLN, and it would be easy to see the movie as a kind of agitprop. But it's also, from the opposite side of the question, a pretty good study of the ends justifying the means, isn't it?
Well, it's more morally ambiguous than that, because, of course, it does depict how the French powers used torture, got information, and destroyed the terrorist infrastructure in the city of Algiers. But also, the point of the film is that the French may have won the battle, but in the end, they lost the war. And in fact, it was their resort to torture and resort to these heinous methods that, in fact, drove most of the population into the terrorists' arms and almost polarized the entire conflict in a way that ensured that the French could not succeed. Not only did the local population turn against their colonial masters, but I think equally as importantly, the population in metropolitan France, not just the intellectuals in Paris, but certainly much of the population was repelled and recoiled at the harsh methods that had to be employed to win the struggle.
I think you mentioned in your piece that the Battle of Algiers has actually been used as a kind of instructional video, both by terrorist groups and counterterrorist organizations. How has it worked that way?
For terrorist organizations, I think it's been an enormously useful means to develop their tradecraft, in other words, their counterintelligence capabilities, to avoid being caught, to give them insight into how the government security forces operate. And we know, for example, that the IRA has viewed it, that the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka have studied it. Supposedly the Black Panthers in the United States in the 1960s also studied it. At the same time, many military and security services have also watched it. I think what one of the most, to me, interesting scenes in the film is when Colonel Mathieu depicts this, what has been described as an organogram, that is this on the blackboard, a sort of pyramid structure with little pyramids within it that indicate the terrorist cells that lead up and narrow down to the mastermind orchestrating the terrorist operation. And I think for security forces, it's enormously useful to see that's a very timeless message that almost all successful terrorist groups operate on a cellular basis, and that the key is finding the nodes and the connections between the cells and then gradually, systematically, relentlessly bearing down on the head of the organization, and that's what the film is about.
Pontecorvo's film was so detailed and of such verisimilitude that he actually had to have a disclaimer in the beginning saying that there's no documentary footage. How did he get such accuracy?
It was, firstly, a joint Algerian and Italian production. So in that sense, he had access and did the shooting in Algiers, in the Kasbah, in exactly the same locations where this battle was fought. Also, and I think fascinatingly, many of the real-life protagonists, many of the terrorists from the 1950s, reprised their roles on screen. Pontecorvo himself led a partisan brigade in Italy, in Milan, in fact, during World War II. So as a guerrilla fighter himself, he knew exactly what he was talking about. And that, I think, is a key element. You're talking about someone who actually had experience in urban warfare and in street fighting.
Pauline Kael regarded Battle of Algiers as one of the great anti-war films. Is it an anti-war movie?
I think what it shows really is just how brutal and how dirty fighting terrorism can become, and indeed how dirty and how brutal, undeniably, terrorism is in itself. Here you have a democracy, the French Republic, who willy-nilly almost slides into the use of these very base and repugnant means. So I think the point of studying this is that eventually any society is confronted with these types of dilemmas. And I think my argument is that it's better to at least take a forward-looking view and begin to consider them and debate them rather than find yourselves boxed into a corner and then adopting things that may prove counterproductive in the long run.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Hoffman is a policy analyst for the RAND Corporation and author of the piece, A Nasty Business, in the current issue of Atlantic Monthly. So, Brooke.
Yeah?
I picked up the Washington Post earlier this week, and I saw a story about Modern Ferret magazine. And I said to myself, golly, I remember hearing a magnificent piece about Modern Ferret magazine on the radio.
I remember hearing a piece about Modern Ferret magazine on our program.
You know what? That was on our show. I did that piece.
My name is Shelton Crute, And I address you today not as an animal professional or a ferret expert, but as a citizen whom your decision today will greatly affect. About 3 years ago, I decided to introduce pets into my life.
However, the venue, a late December hearing of the New York City Council. The subject, legislation that would reverse city health regulations currently prohibiting pet ferrets within city limits. The inescapable lesson, ferret owners care deeply about their pets, which somewhat resemble elongated hamsters, but really, well, think Ronco's pocket otter.
Let's see, we have Nux and Trixie and Bosco da Gama, Balthazar, Cauliflower, Couche, and Gabrielle. They're not rodents. Their ancestors are polecats. They're in the weasel family. Basically, the animals that have that kind of wiggly kind of look.
Mary Schefferman knows just how deeply ferret owners care. From a four-bedroom house in Lake Grove, Long Island, a home office crammed with ferret cages, ferret tunnels, ferret toys, bags of totally ferret food, and seven slender, wriggling little vermin with names, she and her husband Eric publish Modern Ferret magazine. Since 1995, they have combined puckish wit and service journalism to explore everything from ferret heart disease to ferret-owning Playboy playmates to reviews of indispensable ferret products. Eric, the publisher, reads from the tag attached to one of them, a furry mechanical ferret.
I'm a little poop, pal. I'll tell you what I mean. Squeeze my little tummy, you'll get a jelly bean.
They poop jelly beans. Some people find it offensive. Yes.
The key is, though, that some people find anything at all to do with ferrets absolutely irresistible, which is why the Sheffermans had no trouble rallying witnesses for the city council hearings and why for 3 years they could do no wrong with Modern Ferret. They had the ferret lifestyle magazine niche locked up for themselves, and in 1999, right alongside The Economist and The New Yorker, Modern Ferret was judged by the influential media magazine Min to be one of the 12 best titles published in America. Credit genuine devotion, an offbeat editorial sensibility, and, of course, special issues.
On the right here, we have the ferret of the century, which was the Budweiser ferret. It was a very exciting issue for us.
And now, Budweiser's replacement for Louis the Lizard...
No.
The ferret!
That's who they picked?
Real ferrets don't actually say very much, although Mary tries her hardest to loosen Cauliflower's lips.
Would you come out and make a noise? Would you think about it?
When the ferret fails to cooperate, she, of course, jumps to his defense.
They have itch breaks. They get little itches, and then they have to stop everything, and you have to just wait for them. So he's having a little itch break.
Also, it's a weasel, and it doesn't understand what you're saying.
Well, I'm motioning to him to come out, and they do understand that. And he does actually know his name. Right?
Mary and Eric, blissfully happy, if only marginally profitable, lived their dream. Then began the nightmare. Fancy Publications, the Time Warner of the pet magazine business, began to publish a competing title. The juggernaut behind Dog Fancy, Cat Fancy, and Horse Illustrated hit the newsstands with ferrets.
This is typical marketing stuff from them, but they describe About Ferrets. Ferrets is a bi-monthly publication devoted to helping you care for your ferret. It is the only magazine where ferret lovers can find in-depth, accurate current information, seek advice, and interact with other ferret owners. Having launched several years after we had been out there, it's a little tough for them to say that they're the only magazine. This is our whole life's work here, and I'd like my life's work to not be treated as if it doesn't exist.
There is, of course, a limited audience and even more limited number of advertisers in the polecat journalism category. Eric and Mary found themselves living nothing less than the bruising consequences of media concentration. Fancy Publications, according to the Sheffermans, quickly used its distribution muscle to squeeze Modern Ferret out of pet stores, costing them half of their paid circulation. And they say that Fancy's owner, Los Angeles entrepreneur Norman Ridker, has tried to intimidate them into folding.
Before they launched the Ferrets magazine, he actually took me and Mary out to dinner. And he went through this whole explanation of how he's run everyone else out of business in all the other categories that he's done. He told us stories about how he's, you know, sat across the table and, you know, bought someone's whole life's work for pennies on the dollar and watched them cry. And, you know, he really gave us the, we're going to crush you.
Ridker declined comment on the Schefferman's charges, as did Ferrets Magazine's editorial staff. Putting aside right and wrong, however, clearly in the long run, there is no room for two sheriffs in Ferret Town. Complicating matters, Eric has a chronic digestive disorder that has sickened him for weeks at a time, and last year the Sheffermans were able to publish only two issues of Modern Ferret. Still, they pledge to press on.
I don't think we have a choice. Eric and I are very much committed to continuing with Modern Ferret, even if it comes to, you know, I have to go get a job outside the house, and we do this as a part-time endeavor. There's so many things about ferrets that if you don't care enough and it's not part of your life, that kind of intimacy with the ferrets makes you care very much about what you're publishing.
Would it be overstating the case to say that ferrets have actually given you a purpose in life?
That would not be overstating a fact at all. I know a lot of people that they don't need that. They don't need that kind of intense purpose. But I'm one of the people who does need that. And I think it's made me a better person, if I can say that.
But that may not be enough, because self-actualization doesn't pay the printing bills. In the end, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Wise,
among other species.
Enjoy it while you can, hotshots. Your days are numbered.
Louie.
I know a lot of predators, and I know several very large ferrets.
So, Bob, as you mentioned, that piece ran a year ago. Is Modern Ferret still in business?
Yeah, they're still publishing, albeit irregularly. And right now, they're struggling with their next issue in the wake of...
Please don't say September 11th.
September 11th. They were going to devote an issue to ferret-unfriendly zoning in New York City, which ferret owners blame on former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. The next issue of Modern Ferret was going to have an anti-Giuliani tilt, but...
Terrorism strikes again.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up, hard liquor ads on TV and a little urban culture, including the flap over rap at Harvard.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The big news in advertising is that NBC decided to become the first network to break with a 60-year tradition and run ads for hard liquor. The American Medical Association has taken, to put it mildly, a dim view of all of this. Of course, wine and beer ads have been on TV for decades. Millie Webb, the head of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, tells the story about finding a frog on her back porch and showing it to her 3-year-old nephew. He didn't say frog, she says. He said Budweiser. Later this month, TV Guide is releasing a poll that suggests what the public at large feels about the hard liquor ads. And joining us to lay out those findings is TV Guide columnist and OTM regular Max Robbins. Max, welcome back.
Hey, Brooke. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So is NBC doing this now because of a tough economic climate and they want to get money from anywhere they can?
Well, look, they're always looking for new revenue streams. But they're doing it because they think the timing is right. They can use the cover of a poor economy to help get this through. And they really want to tap hundreds of millions of dollars, which are going into other media, and that's for hard liquor.
Other media meaning magazines.
Absolutely. Most of the hard liquor advertising now, that's where it goes, into print.
Now, before NBC runs the hard sells on the hard liquor, it'll be airing a few months of commercials that urge everybody to drink responsibly. Whether this is to inoculate the public or the network against the impact of the ads, I'll leave to you. Is that what this is about, public relations?
Well, what they're saying is that, look, none of the commercials will have people in them that are under 30, that they won't have endorsements from people who young people see as role models. They're saying for every $5 they spend, $1 will go to public service announcements about responsible drinking and about the dangers of drinking. And they're really saying, you know, no more things like Budweiser Frog. This is absolutely a public relations move by NBC and a very savvy one. They've basically enlisted some of the top hands in Washington to help them do this.
There have been some rumblings from Congress that they may be banning liquor ads. How likely do you think that is?
I really don't think it's that likely. There is a little saber rattling in Washington. There's a couple congressmen who said, hey, this is horrible. They're right in lockstep with the AMA and they don't want it. And look, from our poll we found that country's pretty split. About 50% or more people out there think not just liquor ads, but beer ads, all these commercials should be banned from television.
Actually, let's get to the poll. You found that a slim majority disapproved of the ads, and that's all ads, hard liquor, beer, and wine?
It's slim for both. There's a higher disapproval rating for hard liquor ads, less so for beer. That's pretty much split down the middle, beer and wine. Where we did find a real split was women tend to object to any kind of alcohol being advertised on television more strenuously than men.
Are the liquor companies at all concerned, given the what you call the saber rattling in Congress, that pushing these ads onto television might mean banning all alcohol ads? Is that something they're afraid of?
Well, they might tell you that either way this shakes out, they win. Right now, it's not a level playing field for them. Beer and wine companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars to sell their products on television. The liquor companies really have been limited. Their feeling is, look, if we get on and we can go head-to-head and what's more fun to drink, we want to do it. But if, for example, the government steps in and says, hey, get it all out of there, well, the playing field becomes level. So I don't think they're really too scared that they've opened Pandora's box with this.
Well, Max Robbins, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
Maybe it's because Harvard is widely deemed America's premier institution of higher learning, or maybe because Harvard graduates are, shall we say, well represented in the media elite. But the sort of ordinary academic controversies that routinely swirl at other campuses, when they happen at Harvard, tend to make news. This week, a dust-up between the Afro-American Studies Department and the university's president landed in most major newspapers and on the front page of the New York Times. By week's end, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton both were promising to intervene in the situation, as if America's first university had suddenly become the site of an ugly hate crime.
The main players in this tempest were Harvard president Lawrence Summers and university professor Cornel West, who you may recognize from his best-selling book, Race Matters, from his many talk show appearances, or from his latest disc. Hit it, Professor.
And rhythm and blues, mellow, the sharing of soothing sweetness. Have I told you I love you?
Yes, Cornel West cut a hip-hop CD, bringing a little ebony to the ivory tower. Now, from what we've heard off the album, we don't think the man should quit his day job. But we were a bit surprised by President Summers' reaction, as reported in the Boston Globe, that West acted, quote, in ways unbecoming of a Harvard professor.
It wasn't just the CD, which West produced in his year away from the university. Summers reportedly objected to grade inflation in West's courses, and he also took issue with West's heading the Al Sharpton Presidential Exploratory Committee.
Yeah, shuttling between academia and politics. How could Summers countenance that? Or should I say, how could Secretary Summers countenance that? His last job was with the U.S. Department of Treasury. As for grade inflation, that, like Master's T at Dunster House, is a Harvard institution. So the question really is, can a rap CD constitute serious scholarship? Give it up for my tenured homie.
The older generation must bequeath and transmit the best of the old to the new, but the younger generation will meet the challenge.
West's supporters immediately charged Summers with being uncommitted to diversity and affirmative action, and Summers replied by saying his commitment to diversity is unshakable, and by Thursday things had begun to calm down. But I suggest that Lawrence Summers does lack commitment to diversity, diversity of expression. Would a Harvard professor be begrudged for pursuing a passion for, say, chamber music? Even if Professor West wrote a book about the use of popular music to influence the thought patterns of American youth, he'd be applauded.
But because he actually recorded an album of rap, jazz, and soul music in an attempt to influence the thought patterns of America's youth, he was criticized. Not that we expect music history to be especially kind to Professor West. Some of the songs do have a sort of William Shatner sings Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds quality to them. But at least he tried. And if that's unbecoming, I don't know what this world is becoming to. Yeah, sorry about the syntax. I went to Penn State.
Hey, brother, you think about any time in Reverend West, how loved we were, man.
Man, that's what I'm talking about.
I'm telling you.
Woo!
Yeah!
Remembering those 70s, didn't care what life would bring.
When Cornel West ventured into rap, he did not wander out of the cultural mainstream, because a kind of cultural alchemy had already transformed street corner hip-hop and graffiti into platinum watches and billion-dollar deals. It's what the marketers call urban culture. Urban IQ, an urban media research firm, says there are 45 million consumers of urban culture, fully two-thirds of Americans between the ages of 18 and 35. More than half live outside major urban centers. More than 60% are white. Thus, the urban culture consumer, like any consumer, is not defined by who he is, but by what he buys. And by that measure, Viacom is a big-time urban consumer. It paid $3 billion for black entertainment television.
And the reason why BET can be bought and sold for such a high number is because of the people it reaches and because of the advertising potential that the corporations believe that it has.
Keith Klinkscales is the CEO of Vanguard Media, which specializes in urban media and entertainment.
Large corporations don't pay hundreds of millions of dollars for niches.
Artists have a tendency to live on the margins. But when the sums are this large, there seems to be no choice but to follow the money into the mainstream. Crossing over has lost its stigma, says Danelle Alexander, author of the soon-to-be-published memoir, Ghetto Celebrity.
There used to be a really huge price to pay. I remember the George Clinton song from the mid-80s, R&B Skeletons in the Closet, about people like Lionel Richie who had like major roots in music that was sort of off in the margins. When you crossed over, you ran the risk of losing your original audience. Now it's almost embraced.
Though he's crossed over, he's definitely from down at the bridge. He used to take it there. Songs we used to sing, things we used to do. We do no more.
Even in the 1980s, name brand items would turn up in rap music, says Alexander.
My Adidas. It's a teen anthem. When I was a kid, I wasn't even crazy about Adidas, the brand name, but the juice that comes from a great song like that makes you want to go out and buy a pair of Adidas.
My Adidas!
But the fashion stayed in the neighborhood, he says. The venture capitalists didn't see the potential until they heard the cash registers.
When Run DMC came up with My Adidas, they weren't thinking that the anchor of the sports show would be referencing My Adidas.
Not very long ago, Alexander was hired to urbanize the sports cable channel ESPN.
I was the designated hip guy.
He was assigned to help hip-hopify, as it were, the anchors, so they wouldn't sound so square.
Stuart Scott was the key figure in the introduction of urban culture in the ESPN, and that was about 1997 when he first was brought aboard from ESPN2. He was the guy who brought in the vernacular, and at first he was the only person saying it. I know Stuart Scott, and I know at first it caused a lot of waves. At first it was a problem.
I got one time someone said, speak the Queen's English or carry your bleepity bleep on BET where those bleepity bleeps can understand you.
But now it is really purely nakedly absorbed by the anchors who have no pretense of being hip on any level. And it's not just on ESPN. I see it in commercials all the time. You know, in your face, 24/7, these are things that used to be hood expressions.
As of 2001, the style, attitudes, and vernacular of urban culture are fully entrenched into the mainstream culture. Bo Kemp is executive vice president of Vanguard Media. He says urban culture hasn't been damaged in the transition. The art didn't change. The consumers did.
Crossover, in some respects, only is an identifier that something's become very popular. Nothing more than that. And I think some people try to make more if somehow, you know, if you become popular, that means you targeted, you know, whites per se in order to become part of that mainstream, when in fact, all you may have done is produce something that was of such quality that a huge group of people just wanted to buy it.
I think it is going to be co-opted. You know, it is. It's in danger of, and it has been, it will be. That's the nature of where we live.
Talib Kweli has been called hip-hop's positive force. Sincere and plain-spoken, said a reviewer in the mainstream New York magazine, one of the most unusual voices in hip-hop.
Nowadays, rap artists coming half-hearted, commercial like Papa, underground like black markets. Where were you the day hip-hop died? Is it too early to mourn? Is it too late to ride? Is it too early to mourn? Is it too late to ride? Is it too early?
Hip-hop music is a music that comes out of nothing, out of having no money, no resources, no instruments, no anything. And it's about more than just making art or being a rebel. It's about really surviving and living and eating. And other artists, other people sometimes have the luxury of being artists and just being in it just because they love art, not because they needed to get out of the situation they were in. And I want my music to get heard. So I market and promote myself. I make myself into a product. I do it so I could feed my family. I do it so I could feed myself. I do it so I could have a platform and so that things I say can have some weight and relevance in the community so I can affect some change.
There is the possibility of change, but it's limited by the appetites of the market, says Ray Roker, publisher of Herb magazine.
People are watching MTV and seeing Jay-Z or Nelly or somebody that may look like a very, you know, slick thug to them, but now they see them as an artist and as a professional. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it, though, is still playing into people's preconceived notions and their prejudices, because what is being produced by black culture and accepted by mainstream society? What? Rap music? Just, you know, music about diamonds and gold and girls and violence? You know, that's what's accepted in the millions. But if you want to talk about political struggle or what we need to do to save the world around us, that stuff's boring. It doesn't get on TV. It doesn't get on the radio. And hip-hop music, and I think people who really consider themselves real fans of hip-hop music and the old school and everything, wish that it had taken that place that it made for itself, that platform, and used it to really say something.
In other words, the young cross-cultural consumers of urban culture embrace affronts to popular taste and popular mores, but they just won't buy an assault on their complacency. So the best of hip-hop becomes a victim of its own success. But who can argue with success? Not urban media entrepreneur Keith Klinkscales. With visibility comes money, comes real power and real influence.
You know, Hearst owns Oprah's magazine right now, but my goodness, that O is a special thing. It's not just a letter. You know, power comes in many different forces. It's not just in share certificates and what goes on Wall Street.
Urban culture may be fueled by a rainbow coalition of cash money, but it is still a commodity based on racial difference, on the general perception that black urban style, its agility, its ineffable cachet, is what everybody wants to buy. Culture critic Danelle Alexander.
Nelson George, the critic, wrote an amazing essay called The Black Basketball Aesthetic, in which he pointed out players like Jason Williams, who happen to be white, but play black. Players like Tim Duncan, who's a contemporary player and a great player, but he plays like a white guy. He won't sell that many jerseys.
But what does playing black mean? What does playing white mean?
It's the difference between Pat Boone and Little Richard, basically. They could both do Tutti Frutti, you know, and they're two different songs. Oh, bop, bop, a loom, bop, a lop, bop, bop, tutti frutti, oh, Rudy, 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 oh, bop, bop, a loom, bop, a lop, bop, bop. Got a gal named Sue. She knows just what to do. I got a gal named Sue. She knows just what to do. She brought me to the east, she brought me to the west, but she's the gal that I love best. Tutti frutti, oh Rudy, tutti frutti, woo!
Maybe it's because I'm a white kid from the suburbs, but I'm going to go out on Little Richard. Tutti frutti, oh Rudy.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Scott Strickland and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Allison Lichter. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Broken Bones Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And yo, I'm Bob Garfield. Named Daisy, she almost drives me crazy. Got a gal named Daisy, she almost drives me crazy. She knows how to love me, yes indeed. Boy, you don't know what she do to me. To the booty, oh Rudy, 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 to the booty, oh Rudy. Oh, wah, bah, bah, loom, bah, bah, bam, boom.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.